You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this gorgeous Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, broadcasting from the Star Worldwide Network Studios high above Camelback Road. And tonight, my guest is the creator and owner of a website called Make Weird Music. And if that's not accurate, he'll clarify it for me. I might be co-creator from some other things I read. Mr. Anthony Garone, who happens to live in Mesa with his wife and three kids, be on the program right after this first song. And this is a song that Anthony recalled being one of his first favorites growing up. It's a tune called Playing the Game by Gentle Giant.
Listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was Playing the Game by Gentle Giant here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you by TheRecordingArtist.com. And if you happen to have your own little recording habit at home, sometimes you realize that a little professional help can go a long way in making that new song sound pro. So if you ever need a little help, visit TheRecordingArtist.com and check out what they can do for you. And also pick up one of the cool shirts while you're there. And that's TheRecordingArtist.com. And now, without further ado, it is my distinct pleasure to welcome to the show Anthony Garone. Well, how are you doing, Anthony?
I'm good. Thank you.
Sorry, man. Hey, am I saying your last name right?
Yeah.
Okay, I know that's how it's spelled, but I wasn't sure.
Actually, yeah, you got it right on.
Perfect. And you are actually the sole creator of Make Weird Music.
That's right.
Now, Make Weird Music's MWM logo that I'm getting used to seeing on your website and on your shirt you're wearing today.
Uh-huh.
How long has that been in existence?
I think I started it in 2014, early 2014, after a night of kind of desperation when I after so many years of having my personal website to feature my own music that nobody wanted to hear. I just said,
there's a common experience.
I know, right? It's every home musician's plight. But when I said, that's it, I'm tired of promoting myself, I want to start promoting other artists, I just went and bought a domain, and I thought, I like weird music. How about something about making weird music? And then about 8 months later, it really started turning into something.
Wow. Yeah. Now, we're going to talk a bit about that. But before we do, let's kind of talk about how you got into music.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm going to do something here. I can't see you throw this.
I know.
I'm going to move this thing.
Cool.
Yeah, that's much
better.
Thanks. But because you're a musician, songwriter. You've worked as an engineer in studio facilities. Now you have your own businesses. Businesses, we'll say, at this point.
Yeah.
And you're an employee of another business.
That's right.
And you're a programmer.
Yeah.
Developer kind of guy. So, I mean, and you do podcasts and house concerts. And, I mean, you're as bad as me.
Yeah. That's like I think that's what attracted us to each other.
You put it on this business card, and I thought, what am I going to call myself? And I said, there's not a word. So I just started listing everything I do, and I just put it all sideways. It looks like a grocery list, you know?
Right.
Because it's like, well, whatever you need, what do you need to do?
That's
you
know? Right.
But your background, tell me how you got into music, or I guess that song was by Gentle Giant, was an interesting track. And you mentioned that being something you remember when you were young. So when was that in your life? Where were you?
My dad had... he had a band when he was in high school.
Okay.
And that band, all through my childhood, released music and performed live. And I was usually around musicians in the evenings or on the weekends when I saw my dad. That's right. And so he would go to his friend's house, who had a really big house in New York up near Connecticut. And so I would go see him and his band rehearsing in this basement. And they played a lot of progressive rock music. And
which was kind of becoming, this prog rock was becoming popular again a few years ago, but didn't seem to really...
Right, yeah. So I was born in 82, and a lot of the rehearsals that I remember
born
were...
Born in 82.
Yeah, sorry.
Kids these days.
So from maybe 1985...
Just stop for a second. I'm sorry, because I couldn't hear the rest of your sentence after you said born in 82. I got my first full-time job in the recording industry in 1982.
Well, we have a lot in common.
So I've been making records for as long as you've been alive.
Yeah, so I just was exposed to a lot of the music they played, which was Jethro Tull, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and then my dad's record.
Good stuff.
Yeah, lots of really good music
art
from
rock,
that era.
You know,
a lot of art rock, but they tried playing live, so they had to play more accessible music.
Right.
However, the... my dad's record collection was not always accessible music. And so I got into Frank Zappa and Gentle Giant and Henry Cow and Captain Beefheart and all of these different bands just from my dad's record collection. And so I remember there was a cassette tape. It wasn't labeled. It was a TDK cassette.
Oh, yeah.
And I still remember that tape because it had the Gentle Giant Power and the Glory album on it. And when my dad would take us with him to rehearsal, it was a long trip. It was like an hour, hour and a half drive. And I remember that cassette. I always wanted to hear that cassette. And every song on that album, or on Power and the Glory and the other side, was another album called In a Glass House.
Okay.
And so each song on those two albums have very odd, nostalgic, emotional feelings for me. That when I hear them, I remember some distinct things that... I don't know if I'll ever let go of.
Right.
They're not important moments, but I remember that time when I was listening to them. And that song, I think as a kid, is just very appealing.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because we were talking about how production changes and sounds change, you know, and how that doesn't sound like it. It wouldn't be called a cool sound today. But yet what's interesting when you do compare it to, like, popular music, there's still a lot of hooky little melodies in each of the parts.
That's right.
You know, and even that little
marimba.
Marimba bit is like just a...
Right.
You know, it's just kind of clever little stuff that they put in to kind of make it catchy.
Yeah, there's a lot of complicated but very simple things happening that kind of loop, or they change enough, like the bass line over that melody.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think that technique informed so much of my songwriting as I grew older.
Interesting.
So, and you'll hear it in the Victor Wooten song that you talked about playing later. There's so much of that going on. You'll hear one consistent phrase playing over and over, and King Crimson did a ton of this. It's a lot of that minimalist kind of music.
And it's interesting when you point out that that seemed to have an impact on a lot of your writing.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware of that, so maybe the question is moot, but you don't realize that when you're writing necessarily until you hear the record again and you go, oh my God, I've been making that record over and over and over. And I noticed that in some of my own work. Obviously, growing up, I had all the Beatles records before I had anybody else's records.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly a Beatles influence into a lot of what I do. But I didn't realize that how much I had listened to a million times. I'd listened to Casino Royale, which was the Tijuana Brass, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
Yeah.
And then the first time I had an opportunity to make kind of a fun pop record with the whole horn orchestration, I knew exactly what to do. And I'm just telling everybody what to do. And I'm just thinking the record sounds amazing. And the artist kept being told, you know, everyone tells me it sounds like Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. I can't believe that. And so finally, after hearing it enough, I went onto iTunes and pulled up his list, and I said, well, play Casino Royale, because I know I had that 45, and I heard it a million times.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear how he, much, I guess, in the Victor Wooten tune that we were talking about as well, handed off phrasing from one instrument to the other, like almost counter melodies, but not on top of each other. Somebody gets, you know, six beats of the two bars. Somebody else gets overlaps for a beat and takes the last three notes of the melody. So
right.
These melodies are handing off all the time and overlapping to create these interesting phrases.
Yep.
I took a lot of that from that record, constantly creating these parts that kind of handshake through sections.
Yeah, these songs, I feel like they imbue you with some sort of magical knowledge that you don't realize it until you realize it. And then you go, wow. I never would have guessed I got that from that song or that
band.
For
me, that realization was so dramatic with this particular work, I was embarrassed. All of a sudden, I felt like, oh my God, if anybody realizes that, I kind of ripped him off. And I hadn't heard the record in 30 years or 40 years.
Right. Right.
So it was a pretty strange experience. So now, when did you start playing an instrument?
This is an interesting question because I don't really know. I had a little drum kit when I was a kid, very young, and there was some 8mm camcorder footage of me playing it, along with my dad's record. There's a song that has a lot of odd time signatures, and I'm playing the hi-hat and playing the snare and whatever. And so I think that's kind of when I started, but I didn't really pick up an actual instrument until I was maybe 8 or 10 years old. I went through some piano lessons, like maybe 3 to 5,
okay,
and kind of gave up on that. And
three
then,
to five years old, or 3 to 5 lessons.
3 to 5 lessons.
Okay.
They didn't really go anywhere.
Right.
But then in elementary school, picked up the saxophone, and then when I was big enough to play a guitar, my dad showed me some chords. And then when I heard Steve Vai on the radio, I went from chords to nightmarish, you know, practicing all day long, you know,
and
playing as fast as I could. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a cool experience, too. A lot of common things for young people, having heard a favorite record and then sitting in their room for hours on end learning, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
And some of these kids who play guitar fast, which I will call you one of those kids who plays guitar fast, do sweeping, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I was not playing guitar anymore when it came to sweeping and leads.
Right.
I'm like, how do they do that?
Yeah.
You know, and that's, did you ever master that kind of a technique when you were playing kind of?
Oh, I spent hours on, you know, four notes, of course. Yeah. Just constant picking and constant sweeping. I learned everything I could.
That's pretty wild. Now, actually, your life to jump ahead ended up colliding with his, Steve Vai.
That's right.
A little bit.
No, yeah.
I don't know how much of a collision it was. Horrible choice of words. No, really, I ran into him. But tell me a little bit about, I mean, even though we're fast forwarding, how did that come about?
Well, that record I told you about, my dad's record, actually had Steve Vai on it because the bass player in that band, John Sergio, knew Joe Satriani and was taking lessons from Joe as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then John played Aqualung for Steve on an electric guitar in their bedroom or something. And Steve was like, I can't believe you can play that. You got to, how did you learn that? And he says, you got to see my guitar teacher. So then they chipped in. Well, Steve and John paid $5 together to get lessons together from Joe. And I didn't know any of this, but when I was about 14 in 1996, I heard Steve Vai's song Juice from the Alien Love Secrets record on the radio, like on either 98 KUPD or 93.3 KDKB.
Right.
And I had never heard anyone play guitar like that. And so I waited for the DJ, you know, desperately waiting for the DJ to say that was so-and-so. And he goes, that was Steve Vai off his new record. And so we went to Best Buy, because that's where he bought CDs in 1996, and they had it in stock. And I brought it home, and I was blasting it on my stereo, and my dad said, what is this? When he got home from work, I said, some dude named Steve Vai. And he's like, really? Steve played on our first record. I'm like, what?
Before he was Steve Vai.
Right, yeah. And he had played with Zappa by then, but he wasn't famous at that time.
Right.
And so it just happened that John Sergio was coming out to Arizona like months later, and I just thought, I got to learn one of these songs. So I just sat with the disc man 2 seconds at a time learning a song called The Boy from Seattle on a guitar that I borrowed from my uncle.
Wow.
And then we went to Steve's studio just a couple months later, and I met him in person. We stayed in touch over America Online. And then, just instant messenger and email for years. And then in college, I emailed him and he wrote back, let me know when you're ready for an internship. Out of nowhere, I didn't ask. And I said, how about the summer? And he said, great. Come on to the house in May,
man,
and we'll get started.
That's awesome. So he must have had enough going on. He just needed somebody to kind of keep the place up and running.
Yeah,
and
it was between tours and between albums, and it was just an ideal time for me to get there. And my first...
Did your dad have anything to do with that? Did somebody put a bug in his ear?
No,
because you had never expressed an interest in it.
Well, I had written and recorded music, and I sent Steve my CDs over time.
Right.
So, and Steve actually listened to them and would email me
some feedback. And...
Right, and I think he appreciated that nothing I was writing was like normal standard chord changes. It was a lot of stranger music, which is kind of embarrassing now to listen to, but it is special because it was a slice of that time. And I think Steve saw some potential, because that's what Steve does. He looks for people with potential that he can invest in and see what happens.
Right.
So yeah, then I showed up at his house. He said, you're staying in this bedroom. You'll get paid this much per week.
So how old were you when this happened to you?
21.
Okay.
And I worked for him for 7 months straight in his house, in the studio, in both the Hollywood and Encino studios. And then went back to school, but I still did work for his website for a few months. Then I went back the following summer and worked for his neighbor, who's this computer science genius dude that I was not smart enough to keep working for.
Man, there's so many places to go from all that. Let's go back to when you first started the internship. So what were you doing at his place? Were you just cutting some of his demos, or what were you doing?
My first task, he handed me an Altoid and he took one himself and he said, you were contact lenses, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, one of my lenses is stuck in my eye. I need you to help me take it out. So he sat on the toilet and I sat, you know, right in front of him, and I, you know, pop the contact lens off of his eye. So that was my first task, and I
there
knew it was not going to be a normal job.
That is pretty funny.
But for the most part, I was, I just did whatever he needed in the studio. I changed strings on guitars, set up guitars. He had a tape vault that ended up being flooded in the Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to bake his whole tape collection and import them on, you know, 24-inch or 24-track 2-inch Studer. Into Pro Tools, and he had just gotten, this is when the 192 IO had just come out.
Okay.
And so I have a photo of the stack of FireWire 400 hard drives, you know.
Right. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I still have a stack.
Right, yeah. So I just imported all of the original tracks from everything he had, tapes from David Lee Roth, his solo stuff, stuff with other bands like Devin Townsend, other people who'd recorded in his studio, and even the original quarter inch 8 track for Flexible with that machine. hooked up to Pro Tools in a 192 I/O, capturing at, you know, high sampling rates.
Wow.
And I did website stuff. I watched his kids. I did whatever. Just lived in as an assistant.
So did at his studio, did he offer that out commercially? Did he, the bands come in and record there that weren't involved with him playing?
Or, yeah, absolutely.
Like, did you do some of those sessions?
I was, I helped out. I wouldn't say I was a second engineer or anything like that. I was present for many sessions. The first one was with the Yardbirds.
The Yardbirds.
Yeah. Which was interesting.
My first session. Now, wait a minute. You know, that would have been in the 60s. So it's like the Yardbirds were still around working.
Yeah, but it was all the same guys.
Cool.
Except for Jeff Beck.
Right.
But Brian May had come to the studio like to record that day.
Wow.
So, I ran into him twice.
Cool.
And the,
he's a great guitar player.
Yeah. The second was at their, when they got their Walk of Fame star, so mm-hmm. I got to go to that little party thing.
Cool.
But yeah, the Yardbirds were there, and then a lot of people who wanted to be Steve Vai, just unknown people who saved up money to record in his studio, and then artists on his Favored Nations label, like Greg Koch was there, and
mm-hmm.
A lot of guitar oriented people for a while. Do you know Virgil Donati?
No, I do not.
He's a drummer, really technical. He would just go to the studio and practice polyrhythms all day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like 8 to 12 hours of playing 7 on his right hand and 5 on the left, and then, you know, 4-4 on one foot and I don't know, 11 on the other foot, and just constant for 8 to 12 hours a day, days at a time.
I don't even know how drummers play 4-4 with all their hands and feet and
yeah.
play just the different parts in the instrument.
Right.
Know?
Well, he's just a savant. He's yeah. exceptional. I mean, he's a genius in the physical independence realm and the technicality of playing. And he's a concert pianist. He's an incredible, he can play like Chopin and Rachmaninoff
wow.
as well. Virgil's amazing.
So you were working as an engineer on these things. You were running the gear and recording them?
Yeah, I would set up a lot of microphones,
mm-hmm.
Or somebody was coming in and it's like, okay, we got to run so many cables because there's going to be drum kit set up and there's going to be an amp over here. And I might have to set up amps and stands and whatever.
So I imagine that really helped you when you went back home to record. You probably learned a lot about the process.
Oh, my goodness. All I knew working with my dad's equipment was like, here's how to hit record, you know?
Right.
So he had a quarter-inch four-track TIAC that I would use to
record. A 3440
record.
Or?
Yeah, I think it was a 3440.
I had one of those.
And then we upgraded to an ADAT XT,
uh-huh.
so we had 8 tracks on a VHS-C cassette.
Right.
And so I would record with 8 tracks and mixed everything live because
sure.
We didn't have an automated mixer. That was
mm-hmm.
like 1996, 1988, 98.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got back from Steve's, it was like Pro Tools, got an M-Box, you know, all automated mixing. I've learned all about recording amps. It was a huge learning experience.
I was going to say, you probably never thought at all about what mic or where the mic goes. You just put it in front of something. And all of a sudden,
right.
after working in a place like that, you'd have come back and even your own tools were brand new. Like you
Absolutely.
Knew, you knew them in a completely different way.
Absolutely. And Steve, he's surgically precise about microphones and placement. So he would have me bundle up specific mic bundles and in specific positions on a cabinet or in a room.
Bundle as in rubber band together, tape
basically,
together?
Basically, yeah. Yeah,
really
I would use
make
gaffer's
sure the diaphragms
tape.
Are all lined up.
Yeah, gaffer's tape with a 57, a 421, and then this Beyer Dynamic. I forget. It's got a spherical head and it's kind of a thin, longer body.
Was it a ribbon like the M60?
No, it wasn't a ribbon. And then we would use a 414C
mm-hmm.
As a room mic. And he had very specific placements. And he would play, and he would say, Ant, can you move the mics 1 inch to the right?
Yeah.
Can you move it 1 inch up? And he knew.
In, out,
right.
Left, right.
And
yeah.
he would say, okay, are you at a proper 45-degree angle? These kinds of things. So I spent a lot of time learning about miking guitar amps and acoustic guitars working with him.
Mm-hmm.
And his engineer, Neil Citrin, unbelievable like technician, just
right.
incredible. He had Greg Bissonette come in and record a track with just the default Shure, you know, drum kit mics.
Right.
Best sounding drum take I've ever heard. The drummer obviously has a lot to do with it.
It's amazing how much it does. And in fact, I don't think people really understand that. In fact, a lot of recording people probably don't either unless they have the opportunity to work with the really, really great players. And to give you an example of that, I had a house kit, an old Gretsch kit that was a beautiful set, sounded great. And I had worked with a lot of great drummers, and you know, it always sounded great. Mm-hmm. So in comes a gentleman by the name of Michael Botts, who I worked with a number of times. Now, Michael was in a famous band your dad would remember called Bread.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my wife likes Bread.
Okay, well, after Bread, Mike was a full-time session guy in Los Angeles all the time, played on all kinds of records. And I had the, you know, was lucky enough to have an opportunity to work with him, and then I continued to hire him and bring him into Phoenix. So we were working on a record, and it's funny, whenever I would call him and ask him if he would come to town to work on a record, he would say, on one condition. And I'm like, what? He goes, as long as you take me to Richardson's for lunch. His favorite restaurant. The first time he said that to me, I hadn't been there. It's still now one of my favorite restaurants, you know, for years and years. But I was in the room talking to Lee Sklar, who I brought in to play bass. And Mike is in the drum room with the door open right behind me. I'm not looking at him. And all he did was play a drum fill. And I stopped mid-sentence. And I turned around and I said, what did you do? What did you do to the drums?
Right.
They had a certain perfection to the way they sang when he played that fill that I thought, what did you, my drums have never sounded that good. What did you do? And he said, I didn't do anything. I'm like, what do you mean? And it was just the way he played.
It's the touch.
The simple dynamic expression between the hits, the spacing,
That's right. Speed.
He had a tendency to use speed where we all fight that with time. Mm-hmm. And he had a way to use that. And another example, you know, if I can talk all the time of the
course,
show.
Yeah. But
another great example that Mike showed me is we had done a record where it was a drum machine and he was the last guy on it. And so, you know, it doesn't speed up. But yet every time it came to the chorus, it felt like it sped up. And it got faster and faster and faster. And I knew it was impossible. So I asked him afterwards, how are you doing that? You know, how are you making us all feel like this thing's getting faster? And he said that what he does is he would slow down slowly across the length of the verse, get slightly behind the beat, and then he would speed up during the drum fill like most drummers do anyway,
right?
And hit the chorus feeling like he'd just sped up. And then he would just keep the hi-hat kind of in front of the beat through the chorus. And then he would just slowly drift behind the click track again through the verse. So you never felt the slowdown, but you always felt the speed up.
Right. It's the subtle dynamics and that independence. The way a real good drummer can think and approach the instrument as an instrument, not just a percussive thing that supports a beat. You know?
Yeah, and let me ask you this. I've always felt that when you watch drummers play, that there are two types. There are drummers who decided they wanted to be drummers and learned it, and there are drummers who were born to be drummers. And it's like so obvious to tell them apart.
That's right.
So you, in fact, were playing drums as a kid before you could play anything. So now, did you go on with drums?
It's funny, I never did.
It seems like you might have been a natural drummer.
I don't consider myself a natural at many things, and I'm not saying I'm a great drummer,
right?
But I don't have to practice the drums. It's a very strange thing. I've played it at church for quite some time, and the only time I played was at church.
During the live show.
That's right, and I could just show up and play. And I don't know why that's always stuck. Now, I can't do like really technical things,
right,
and I have trouble with syncopation and those kinds of things. But it's like the guy who sits down at the piano and just starts playing stuff. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what I'm doing. That drums are like the only thing in my life that are like that. But I don't even take advantage of it. And drums are expensive and big and loud.
Yeah.
I have a digital kit that I use for laying down ideas. But for some reason, I just don't spend much time on the drums.
Do you still have a saxophone?
No, my cousin has it. But I did get to play saxophone and flute a few times with my dad's band as a teenager. We played Jethro Tull conventions.
Oh, cool. Oh, wow.
So I remember playing soprano sax on one song. And, you know, I learned the flute because the fingerings were the same as the alto saxophone. And so I remember we were playing in Vermont at the same a club called Nectar's in Burlington, where Phish started. And we played all of the album Passion Play. Mm-hmm. And then we played Minstrel in the Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to play some parts in that. I didn't play any flute at that time, but I played soprano sax on a song or two.
So today, would you consider your primary instrument guitar?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I've spent so much more time on the guitar than anything
else. Well, let's play one of your songs.
Okay.
Let's play a song called Three-Legged Dog.
It's a new song.
It's a new song. Tell me a little bit about this track and what your role is on the recording we're about to hear.
Sure. I started it in 2013 as kind of a mental exercise. What would happen if Chet Atkins and Steve Howe were somehow having to write a song with John Petrucci of Dream Theater? And I thought that was a funny concept. So I just wrote, I still do play a lot of that, like Tommy Emmanuel, Chet Atkins kind of stuff. Country picking. So this is kind of like an atonal or a more heavy chicken picking kind of song. I started in 2013 and it was too complex for any of my casual drummer friends to want to play on it. So I hired a Swedish drummer who played with Frank Zappa named Morgan Ogren, and then another friend in Germany who it's his band. It's a jazz metal band, and they play very, very complex music.
Jazz metal. Cool.
Yeah. There's a section of the song later on. It's a second guitar solo that sounds totally different from the rest of the song. That's Jan Serfeld's section. And then my friend John Landy, I met on Craigslist through drummer Paul Sears, who played with a band called The Muffins locally. And John's just an incredible bass player. He's a natural. And so, it took 4 years for this song to get finished, but I just released it a couple months ago.
So you didn't, this isn't an example of everybody got together to play. You actually did your guitar bits, and then when you got people involved, you let them do their tracks.
That's right.
And then just put it all together. So then you did the final mixing or blending.
My friend Russell Muller, who's an engineer in town, I asked him if he would do it, and he did.
Cool. I like how that works.
Yeah.
So this is on iTunes for people if they want to check it out?
No.
Or where is it available? On your website?
It's just on YouTube.
Oh, just to kind of
if someone wants the MP3, they can just message me and I'll send it over.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So here, and is their name an official name of the band or is it just...
No. Make Weird Music is going to release a lot more music over time. That's just a conglomeration of people who are the right fit for the song.
So this is essentially just a song released by Make Weird Music.
It's a Make Weird Music production.
There you go. See, now that's the idea. The artist really should encompass everyone involved. It's the producer, the engineer, and the musicians and the writers. They are the artist on that piece of work.
That's right.
That's interesting because this represents an evolution of that term, which I think is required today.
It's art. It's not me.
Right. It's everybody. Let's check it out. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And I am your host, Otto Daniolo, here on the Otto D Show, where my guest this evening is Anthony Garon from Make Weird Music. But that's not the only thing. Anthony has a couple other gigs as well. So as a computer science major with a degree, I guess, yeah. So you're not a major anymore, you're out of school.
Uh-huh.
But you actually do that for a living. You work in the computer field.
That's right. For many years, I was a full-time programmer. I did IT network stuff and wrote a lot of web applications and website stuff, websites and content management systems. And now I manage a team of about 25 or 30 IT and programming professionals.
Now you're in people management.
Yes. And that has led to...
It's rare for computer guys.
Exactly. And I think that's where the music thing comes in.
Interesting.
But... that led to starting a company with my friend Alan called Kensho Education. So Melt Media.
How do we spell that?
Kensho. And Melt Media pays the bills for me, you know, my day job. Kensho Education is something that I hope pays some bills over time. It's a goodwill effort to fill in the gaps between what I see as the potential for a software developer and what they actually do. They have all the tech skills, but in many cases lack the soft skills, you know? And so this is really a program to help not just programmers, but anybody with communication and relationships with themselves and at work.
Mm-hmm.
And then Make Weird Music I call it my third job. And it's a hobby, and it generates money through donations and t-shirt sales. But that money goes straight into the site. Or into hardware that helps me build, you know, stuff for the site.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the site because, you know, I had an opportunity to visit it. And it's interesting because one of the things that was an absolute no-no back in the day, and still if you talk to branding people, is you can't have more than one message and you can't be confusing. But what's weird is today it's almost more like we'd rather see a few things around.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to Make Weird Music, you don't really know what you're getting at first. It's like, is this a label? Is this a interview show? Oh, it's just a list of artists that are for sale. No, there's these home concerts on YouTube.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, you do a lot of creative things relating around whatever music it is that you feel like you'd like to share.
That's right,
you know,
yeah.
Or represent to people. And in getting to the site, I had an opportunity to watch you introduce Michael Manring in a house concert, and I hadn't necessarily heard Michael play, and I was like, oh, my God. I got to have that guy sit in my room and score a film in real time while we're watching the screen. I mean, incredible player with some really emotive styles of effects he's using when he's playing.
Yeah, I saw a video of him that my friend took at a NAMM show in 1999 or 2000, maybe 98. And ever since then, I wanted to see him live. And he never came to Arizona. He played with Michael Hedges.
Okay.
And he played in 1993 in Arizona with Michael Hedges. Okay. And that was the last time he had been here. And when Make Weird Music was starting to turn into a real thing, I emailed him. I said, can I interview you? He said, sure. And I was going to San Francisco. So he said, here's my address. And I was like, oh, my goodness. You know?
Oh, cool.
Right. So I went to his house, did an interview. And then I asked him if he would ever do a house concert. And he said, sure. And then I thought, you know, flying to from San Francisco to Phoenix isn't going to be that expensive. And I could probably raise money for his fee. And then I wouldn't need that much hardware. So it was worth it. And so Make Weird Music hosted the first Michael Manring show in Arizona. And hopefully not the last. But yeah, it was in my dining room.
Awesome.
And if you go to the YouTube video, you would never guess it's my dining room.
Well, I wondered where it was shot. It looks like a nice, you know, comfortable, cozy place. It's not a big, big room.
No.
But you can see there are people in the audience.
That's right.
I couldn't really count how many.
There are about 40 people there.
Okay.
Yeah. So the room, it barely fits 40 chairs.
Right.
And then Andy West from the Dixie Dregs.
Right.
He's friends with this lighting guy in the valley, and he brought three trusses of lights. I thought there would be like two spots or something.
Because Andy's playing.
Well, yeah.
With Michael.
Yeah. And so this guy, Michael Nitro, he's a local.
I know Michael. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it's Michael. Yeah. So he brought a truck full of lights. And I was like, what is going on? But it made a huge difference.
Cool.
So we had Michael Manring out. And then Mike Keneally, who played with Frank Zappa, among other amazing musicians, did another house concert. And Andy West played at both. And I'm hoping to have one or two more house concerts in the next 6 to 8 months and just try to do one or two a year.
So people can access these or view these how?
If you go to makeweirdmusic.com, there's an archive section for all the content on the site, and then you can filter it by category. And we've got two concerts on there.
Okay, and so they end up being essentially links to YouTube videos?
Basically, yeah.
You have a YouTube... I guess you do have a YouTube channel, but you don't promote it separate from the page.
No, everything is Make Weird Music. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Mm-hmm. Just type Make Weird Music. I'm the only one out there.
Mm-hmm. I always often ask my guests before the show, you know, what kind of music that they listen to or what they're inspired by. And sometimes it's a difficult question to answer. And you gave me a list of a few records that you were kind of interested in today. You started it by mentioning, well, I don't know, you know, I don't really have that much opportunity to listen. And then you rattled off a bunch that matter to you.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, that's kind of cool. You mentioned one, music for 18 musicians. You referred to it as a constant in your life.
Yeah. That, I don't even remember where I came across it. But from the opening four measures, I just was hooked. And now I listen to it at least once a month, just as I'm working. Mm-hmm. It's hypnotic music. It's beautiful. In headphones, it's incredible. It's an experience because there's vocals that are moving from one channel to the other through mm-hmm. pulses. And the whole thing is built on pulses and rhythms. And so, you know, it's just this constant fading in and out of all these different instruments and from voice to marimba. And there's 18 musicians. I just think it's so beautiful, and I listen to it when I really need to focus on work or when I really just want to mentally escape and meditate or something, you know?
Very interesting. You introduced me to a couple other groups I was unfamiliar with. Chan,
mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard of.
Yeah, they're a bunch of young dudes out of San Diego. It's a trio.
Oh, okay, yeah, with a song called No Signal, which is very cool.
Yeah, actually, it's a quartet. It's two lead guitarists, a drummer, and a bassist, and they're just, it's all instrumental. You could call it shred music, mm-hmm. but it's all clean guitars,
right?
And beautiful and unique songwriting. There's a few bands that are like them, but Chan is the only one that I particularly care for. Strawberry Girls is another one they toured with that is very interesting and musically and everything, but I feel like Chan just does something special.
And then tell me about the Conscious Club by Wolfpack.
Well,
I went to look at the link for YouTube, and it's like it's a 32-minute.
Well,
is it like one album, or is that
all was
the
whole
put
album?
Together?
Yeah, the link I sent you just goes straight to that song on the
oh,
album.
Oh, I see.
But Wolfpack, that's a story. My daughter's name is Christine, but she's 6 years old, and she maybe around 4 years old realized her name is like Chris Dean.
Okay.
D-E-A-N, right?
Right.
And so we call her Dean.
Oh, wow.
And
it's pretty wild.
I just looked on Spotify for Dean, and that was the first song that came up, Dean Town, off of that album with Conscious Club. And it turns out Wolfpack is this really innovative, creative band out of Brooklyn. They were famous for creating a silent album on Spotify called Sleeper that they would have all their fans play overnight. And they raised enough money to fund a free tour around the country.
Wow.
So they used all that Spotify money to have free concerts and travel around the country.
By playing no music on Spotify at night.
That's right. And they are just a modern funk dance rock band. And that song, Dean Town, I just played it because I was like, hey, Christine, there's a song for you. And I listened to it. I was like, these musicians are great. You know, it was just a total coincidence. And
wow.
The song Conscious Club on that album is like a tour de force of musicianship, humor, and they blend like 70s funk with modern sound. So mm-hmm. it's a fantastic song.
Well, there you go, kids. Check it out.
Yeah.
And another record, something I do want to play, because mm-hmm. the first time I actually heard this track was after you had sent me a link and mentioned it as being something that was particularly, you know, impactful for you, and that's off of Victor Wooten's Palmistry album.
Yeah.
Which came out, I think it was in February?
No, like 2008, I think.
Oh, I thought I read February. I mean, I'm forgetting what I was
no,
reading.
No, it's okay. You had said recent music, and I was like, I don't know if I can think of anything new. The Chan song sent you was new.
Right.
But maybe that was 2012.
It shows you how familiar I am with Victor's catalog. Sorry.
That's Victor. Okay. No.
But this
it could
song,
be much newer.
A particular song on that record, which is the opener, Two Timers.
Yeah.
What a song.
And it blends so many wonderful techniques. And almost everyone who's on Make Weird Music asks, if they're not weird, they ask about the word weird.
Right.
Like, there's a guy named Ostrich Von Nippel I interviewed. He didn't have a problem with weird, you know. Right. But other people are like,
Ostrich Von
what
Nippel.
Is with weird, you know?
Or what does weird mean? Do I fit in your weird?
Exactly. You know? And I don't mean it in a derogatory or like an exclusionary way. Weird to me is any artist that is true to him or herself, doing what he or she feels is so intrinsically motivating to them. And so you can tell if someone is making something to make a nice song, or if someone is doing something to make a work of art. And so I really want to promote music as a work, as an art platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this Victor Wooten song really does that. It uses so many techniques to make a beautiful song that anyone would like. But the musicality of it is very high, and the techniques used in terms of time signatures and polyrhythms and those kinds of things, to the average listener, they wouldn't care. But to a musician, it's so engaging, and it gives you so much to feed on.
Well, and you feel every one of the changes.
That's right.
But the impact is really that it's such a dance. It feels like such a dance.
Absolutely.
Between those sections.
And the chord changes, they're beautiful, and there's a couple unexpected turns, and it's perfect. It's
well, let's
perfection.
Listen to a little bit of this as maybe the inspiration for, you know, Make Weird Music.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was a little Victor Wooten two-timers off of Palmistry. You like that one, Anthony?
Oh, man. I love everything about it.
As we started to play it, I pulled my headphones off and I said to Anthony, hey, you know, it's like 5 minutes long. I'll just play half and we'll get back. He's like, no. Play the whole thing. It's a beautiful song.
It is so beautiful. You had talked about what I do as a computer person, among other things. And really, Make Weird Music to me is my, it's my offering to artists that I care about who don't have those skills, but those skills are really important. How many artists are out there that don't know how to put something on a website, right? So Make Weird Music is really a platform to promote artistry. And I don't consider myself the kind of musician that I feature on the site. I'm really proud to be able to work with any of them or even just to speak with any of them. But the site is a gift mm-hmm. for them, mm-hmm. for people like me who just resonate with this kind of music. And there's no one funding it. It comes out of donations and my
less
pocket.
Less and less. You know, I mean, even the music, right. You might be referring to the website.
Well, the website in particular. And I think it's important because music journalism is funded by mm-hmm. ads and by headlines and those kinds of things. I don't consider myself a music journalist, but that's kind of what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I really just want to have a platform where I can showcase beautiful artistry without any limitations, with no sponsors telling me what I can and cannot do. And if I have a sponsor, it's merely for them to help fund doing this.
What you're doing.
Right.
And how can people reach you? Are you open to people submitting work to you or even just sharing with you things they think belong on your site that you may not be...
Absolutely. I'm always open to ideas. But rather than me be on the critical path, be the person behind it,
right.
I want it to become something bigger. So if anyone is interested in helping out, whether that's writing content, you got to be a good writer, or helping out with social media stuff or doing art. I do all the art on the site, too.
Which is really cool, by the way.
Thank you. But some of the art could be much better.
Well, I found it to be, that's the branding bit of it, because mm-hmm. the content isn't branding. It's the content is very different
yeah.
From videos to tracks to all kinds of stuff. But yet the look of the site is the
it's
thing that brands it to me. That
yeah.
was like, I know where I'm at. Now I can see a shirt with those images or any product with those images, and I would think of Make Weird Music.
That's really cool, and so, that's what I'm after. Yeah. So if anyone wants to help, whether that's through submission or donation of their time or their skills or money or writing, whatever, I'm open. I don't want the site to be for me. It's not the Anthony Garone website.
Right.
I just am the catalyst for it, and my skills have allowed me to build this. And the art is already there. So this is just a platform that allows the art to be magnified.
So this is, you got a lot going on. You've done a lot of things.
Yeah.
You're still a child. You're only 35 years old.
Yeah.
You've got a family and kids.
That's right.
So any big plans? What do you want to do next? Even if next means like 10 years from now, I've got this idea. You
with Make Weird Music or?
Yeah, maybe or not. Just what else you see going on in your life in the future?
I want to have a balance where I've got a job like I have with Melt Media.
Right.
I've got a job like Kensho.
Mm-hmm.
And and Make Weird Music is another kind of job where I can work on all three evenly
mm-hmm.
Or as I see fit, and I'm able to balance them better instead of full time one place, spare time another place, and if I have energy, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kensho is a huge opportunity. But I still want to keep my one foot
in
the real world.
And we didn't talk a lot about Kensho. Can
right.
you give me the website? Is there a website for Kensho?
KENSHO.IO.
So people can check it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I want to have one foot in the real world, the practical world, where people are actually working.
I've never tried that.
I know, right? But Kensho won't be successful if we're not relevant, right?
That's right.
So I've got to balance the relevance, and Make Weird Music is the artistic side of me where I'm hoping that at some point I can just stay home in a studio and do all three.
Yeah. Well, it sounds to me like that's exactly what will happen if that's what you want to happen. And as much as you're describing your not necessarily a need for balance, but your want for balance, you have created great balance considering all that you're doing, how much you're doing for other people and with a family at home.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty incredible.
Thank you very much.
And we're running out of time.
Thank you.
I can't believe how fast an hour goes by when it's interesting to talk.
Yeah,
you know?
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. I appreciate you taking up my invitation.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So everybody check out makeweirdmusic.com because it's worth your time.
Thank you.